contemplation. They will jump on your misfortune when you're down. They're talking, just walking.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Bob Dylan's Ain't Talking from his album Modern Times, to introduce today's show, which is about talking that ain't really talking, or perhaps people talking and governance not listening. We will hear voices from South Africans concerned with the impact of steep electrical hikes on their country and how and why our listeners all over the world should be concerned. Eskom, South Africa's Electrical Supply Commission, is a parastatal or government entity that supplies the entire country with electricity. Eskom is proposing a 35% rate hike for each of the next 3 years to pay off World Bank loans of up to $5 billion for its so-called New Build program. The vast majority of South Africa's electricity is generated from coal, and South Africa already has one of the heaviest carbon footprints in the world. The World Bank is on board with what they're calling this New Build, and they're quoted as saying the New Build will achieve financial stability, increase generation capacity and efficiency, and adopt a low carbon trajectory. Now, the National Energy Regulator of South Africa, known by its acronym NERSA, has held hearings in communities around South Africa to allow a cross-section of the society to talk about their view of the rate hike. At the January 18th NERSA hearing held in Durban, KwaZulu-Natal, about 600 residents from South Durban added their voices to the public discussion. I talk with Patrick Nkizi, who's the spokesperson for Wentworth Development Forum, also youth activist Bongani Mtembu from Mlazi Township, and Marvin King, also from Wentworth in South Durban. Following that, environmental research campaigner Rico Europido from the NGO Groundwork shares the overall context in which to understand these concerns raised during the NERSA hearings. Sporting t-shirts with a variety of messages, including no more lies, service delivery now, and they tell me to go to hell but they are the corrupt ones. About 600 people protested the National Energy Regulator of South Africa's hearings held in Durban, KwaZulu-Natal recently. I asked Wentworth Development Forum spokesperson Patrick Nkizi from South Durban to describe the protest.
Well, today is supposed to be a public hearing here where various organizations and possibly individuals will be making presentations with regards to the proposed 35% tariff hike by Eskom. And we are basically here from the Wentworth Development Forum with all those people who are protesting outside to make sure that our voices are heard, in that right now the level of unemployment has actually made it almost impossible for people to cope with the current prices. And it's going to be worsened with this 35% hike.
It's 35 for the next, 35 every year for the next 3 years.
Every year for the next 3 years, which means it's something like 140% in 3 years' time. And we are saying it's going to make it difficult. Yet energy, just like water and any other important immediate resource to a human being to survive, is a right, not a privilege. In fact, if we had a true democracy here, not driven by profits, this country, which has been hailed by many countries with as having the best constitution, should be giving energy for free to the people, considering the history of where we come from, where people were segregated in terms of race and others having more benefits than others. We still are in the animal farm situation type here in this country, because the line of divide is between the rich and the poor, and the rich does not mind that electricity is increased, but the poor is of concern, because it's going to be back to candles for many families, back to paraffin stoves, which are actually notorious of accidents that are happening, burning of the houses by accidents. So we are heading for a disaster, and our view here is that this thing has to be stopped right here and now.
So all of these people came up from South Durban. About how many?
Well, we had six buses So we're talking of close to 600 people.
And let's talk a little bit about the fact that people have to come by buses. These are people that really don't have their own cars, right?
Yes.
They're being bused up here, and if they were not bused here, their voices would not be heard today.
Yeah, if they were not put into buses, their voices would have not been heard. Yes, you are correct.
So some of them are taking time off work?
Yes, especially on a Monday. And the decision to come here and protest was taken on Wednesday last week. And so they only had Thursday and Friday to ask their bosses to be excused for this important day today.
Give a description for our listeners in the United States about a typical household that these people are coming from.
Well, there's electricity, and most of them who live in flats, they share the power meters. But you find that some are charged less tariffs than others. Those who are charged more than others probably use less electricity. But our fight mainly is about industries that are the most consumers of electricity. And where we live, we are surrounded by industries. They are the most consumers of electricity, but they pay less. And we are saying it's wrong, it's daylight robbery. In fact, industry should be paying more, because the more you consume should be the more you pay. But it's a different situation here. Seemingly the poor is paying for industry, the owners of industries, the polluters, to become more fat cats.
They're subsidizing the fat cats.
Yeah, they're subsidizing the fat cats.
And so what do the fat cats say when you tell them this?
Well, the fat cats don't listen. Those people don't listen. But we hope that Eskom, as a parastatal, having the government being the main shareholder, will take our concerns today and perhaps do something about that.
Now, Patrick and Kizzy, are the folks that are now, I just came from there, they're all behind the gate. They're so far not allowed in. Are they going to be able to come in here?
No, they're coming in. We have negotiated that they come in. They just put conditions that they don't sing, they don't howl. These are decent people, though they are the poor, but they are decent people. So they are going to comply with those unreasonable requests. Because if you don't like something, you have a right sometimes to heckle and say, no, this is nonsense.
Right.
But they'll come here. We'll try and do our best in representing their interests.
Now, is there any possibility that some folks may lose their jobs because of taking the day off today?
Well, it's not so, because those who had asked us to write letters on their behalf, we have done so.
Okay.
And we have got responses. We demanded responses from their employers that they are given permission. So far, I haven't heard of anybody who has just unilaterally come, joined the protesters without a permission to be away from work.
Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, madam.
Bongani Ntembu is a youth activist who lives in Umlazi, the largest township in South Africa after Soweto. His astute and both humorous and blistering presentation to the panel of energy regulators was appreciated by many in the audience. I talked to him after his presentation.
Umlazi, it's the biggest township after Soweto in the whole country in South Africa. So I'm representing that same township. I'm from a youth organization from the township.
Okay.
Exactly.
And so you gave them hell in here.
Yeah, for sure. We had to, because we see that there's a need for us as youngsters, more especially, to be involved in such decision makings, so that we can raise and air our experiences and our grievances. So we saw a need that we need to be here and represent and tell them exactly that we cannot say yes to the 35% increase. At the moment, we are failing to pay the tariffs because they are very high from Eskom.
So what would you like people in the U.S. to know about what's going on here with Eskom?
We would really like for the U.S. Comrades to acknowledge that we really suffering tariffs from Eskom. They are very high. Some people, they cannot put bread on the table, and yet some of them, they are pensioners. The same pension, the pension that they are receiving, it all goes to Eskom. Yeah, due to the electrical bills and everything. So we are saying no to the 35% tariffs.
And so is there some way that U.S. people can put pressure on Eskom?
Yes, for sure. Well, we really appreciate for the comrades from the U.S. to put pressure on the government with NERSA as the regulators to make sure that whatever Eskom is planning, they must make sure that they mustn't put the poor of the poorest not affording to sustain themselves, to sustain them, their family, and they must really think for the poor, because we are the most affected people. So in other words, you cannot solve a problem with a problem. Eskom is trying to increase the tariffs, yet there are people who cannot afford to recently pay the tariffs that they are offering, that they are putting on the table.
How can people get in touch with you directly?
My email is sdcea04@mail.ngo.za. You can get in touch with SETI, it's South Durban Community Environmental Alliance.
Okay.
We work very closely with you.
Thanks a lot.
No, pleasure. Thanks.
Bongani Ntembu from Mlazi. Get in touch with him, as he said, at sdcea04@mail.ngo.za. If you want to know more about these South Durban communities and activists, do an internet search for the South Durban Community Alliance, the umbrella group for a number of activist groups in the area who support local communities and bring awareness about the many environmental, health, and social issues affecting those communities. Raising Sand Radio will soon air more information on the South Durban Community Alliance. Now, Marvin King boarded one of the 6 buses to Durban from her home in Wentworth, South Durban, to protest the rate hikes.
I'm here to represent Wentworth concerning the lights.
So Wentworth now, for people in the U.S., Wentworth is south of Durban.
Wentworth is south of Durban, but Wentworth is a polluted area at the moment.
How so?
3 of my sisters that got suffering with asthma. My brothers have got a blocked nose, which has got to go through an operation any time. The same pollution.
And what kind of pollution is it?
He worked for Engen. What I'm really doing here is concerned about the elderly people, the pensioners. Their light bills come to R1,000, some of them come to R900, and what are they really earning?
Their pensions are about what?
R1,010. Okay. How do they manage to pay their bills with that little bit of money they're getting? And with my age, I can't even get into any jobs.
You're not retired though?
I'm unemployed.
But you're not eligible for retirement or pension at this point?
No, not at this point.
So what do?
I do housework.
And that keeps you going?
It keeps me going.
How many people in your family?
There's 4 in my family.
And are others working?
No one's working.
No one's working. So what do? How do you survive?
I survive in the housework and I collect one child support.
So you trucked up today in the bus with about 200 people or so?
Yes.
And is it turning out to be what you expected?
It's well worth it.
For a while there, I saw everyone locked outside the gate and I was concerned.
We were locked out.
Yeah.
The thing is, in a lot of places, when there's something that you want to speak about, let your voice be heard, doors don't get open in a hurry.
Yeah.
Because they're scared you might be coming to fight with them or something.
Well, we just heard from Bongani Ntembu in there, and he was quite straightforward about what he wanted.
I appreciated the way he spoke. He spoke well for us.
And he also didn't insult the people on the panel.
No, we never.
He was very careful.
Very careful, his
but,
words.
But someone needed to speak very strongly, and he seemed to do that.
He did.
So he also represents your issues.
Yes, very good.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was Marvin King from Wentworth, who came to the hearings to make her voice heard and aired concerns facing her community. You're listening to Raising Sand Radio on Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, bringing you progressive topics and views each Monday from 2 to 3 U.S. Pacific Time. Today, we bring voices from a recent NERSA hearing, that is the National Energy Regulator of South Africa, a panel of energy regulators gathering information about a proposed rate hike of 35% for each of the next 3 years. We hear from our guest today that this hike will greatly impact all South Africans, but especially hard hit will be those already hard-pressed due to under- or unemployment, those living on fixed incomes and pensions, and the youth, who represent about 40% of South Africa's population. A low-income household that currently pays about 360 rand per month by next year will pay 1,000 rand. A suburban household that pays about 750 rand this year will pay 2,400 rand. There is a free basic electricity quota of 50 kilowatt hours that will rise to about 70 kilowatt hours, but a quick glance at your own power bill will show that this is still a trivial amount. Meanwhile, Eskom is regularly quoted in the media saying that it will institute the 35% increases despite the public input. Pharmaceutical multinational GlaxoSmithKline recently stated that it would pull out of South Africa if the rate hike is instituted, indeed that it does business simply because of the very positive profits that it can generate here in South Africa, and that if it sees the possibility of these profits diminishing, it will not stay in this country. Consider that such big corporations pay about 11 cents per kilowatt hour, while household customers pay 44 cents per kilowatt hour. Listeners can go to NERSA's website, that is NERSA, nersa.co.za, for more information on NERSA's views of these hearings.
They will crush you with wealth and power. Every waking moment you could cry.
For a deeper understanding of the interdependent issues associated with Eskom, we turn to Rico Europito, a research campaigner with the environmental organization Groundwork. This NGO works with communities all around South Africa concerned with environmental justice. Rico Europito begins with a description of Groundwork, the NGO Groundwork.
Groundwork is a funny type of organization. We're an NGO, an environmental NGO, but we have a strong emphasis on environmental justice and environmental rights. So we're not your traditional green environmental NGO. More like a brown NGO that focuses on peoples and people's struggles, and we try to give some strength to community struggles, especially when they receive the short end of the stick in relation to polluting industry.
And the short end of the stick is exactly what they seem to be getting right now with Eskom. Recently, we participated in a conference, and some of the local people came to express their concern about a very big 35% rate increase. So I want to talk about that, but it makes sense to allow our American listeners to understand more about Eskom, what it is, how it came about, and how it really operates in this country.
Eskom is our energy peristatal in South Africa. Peristatal implies that it's wholly owned by the government. It's not private in any way. However, it acts more like a private company, which is one of the big concerns that many people have with Eskom, because it acts like a private company and not quite like something that's owned by the government, that in, you know, to all intents and purposes should provide a service to the people that that rely on it for energy.
Give an example of how it acts like a private company.
One of the interesting comments that were made by the Eskom CEO when he introduced the justification for the 35% tariff increase at this meeting that we attended was that he spoke of profits, and it was an oversight on his behalf, because Eskom isn't meant to profit. What it's meant to do is have either a surplus or a deficit. And he quickly rescinded on using the word profit and reverted to using surplus. So that was one example of how Eskom increasingly acts as a private company and not necessarily in the public interest, instead of the public company that it is, which is wholly funded by the government.
Well, actually, on this topic, I learned that the ANC, for example, has shares in Eskom, and that there's something called Chancellor House, which is the investment arm of the ANC. What is that?
Yeah, I mean, that's also something that's emerging as a worrying scenario in South Africa. For instance, when the ANC, as a political party, not necessarily as the government, the ANC as a political party has an investment arm, and its investment arm has vested interest in getting preferential treatment when applying for tenders for business, because its investment arm meets all the criteria for social reform, social redress, economic redress. So if the ANC's investment arm is preferred to receive government tenders, the ANC, the political party, then I don't necessarily think that's in the interest of the public, because the ANC, the government, is more likely to provide the ANC, the political party, with preference for lucrative contracts that will benefit it. And this is a problem in South Africa.
As an aside, on this topic of the political party, the ANC holding shares in firms that benefit from public contracts, Bantu Holomisu, leader of the United Democratic Movement, said the ANC must rid itself of such shares. He said this owning such shares creates, quote, a conflict of interest that leads to bad governance and corruption. We now have a situation where Eskom's plans are not possible unless they fleece the public, unquote. He continued, the UDM therefore calls to Parliament to intervene and appoint an independent judge to assist NERSA and strengthen their hand to consider the entire Eskom situation and all the implications for the economy and the public. Let's go back to Rico Europito.
There was a protest yesterday. I was there as a reporter, as a witness, and as a quasi-participant, as a supporter of the people. A lot of people came in from South Durban.
That's right, yeah.
And a lot of these people are from areas where not only are their income is depressed, but their actual environment that they live in is degraded.
That's right. So I think you've hit the nail on the head. The South Durban Basin is a particularly polluted environment, and the people who live there are generally much poorer, sort of lower middle class to lower working class people, if we had to classify people in a conventional sort of way. They generally people who are blue collar workers who work in either the oil refinery or...
The oil refinery is...
Engine refinery.
Okay.
Yeah. There are two oil refineries in the South Durban Basin, so it's even more polluted than you might have thought. One is an Engine oil refinery, which is partly owned by Petronas, and the other is what's called the Sapref refinery, which is owned by Shell and also the South African government. Additionally, there's a big pulp and paper plant in the area, lots of small to medium-sized enterprises, chemical works that arise as a result of the oil refineries. So, a diverse suite of industries that in nature are polluting, especially considering that South Africa comes from a poor environmental legislation starting point. It's only just recently, within the last couple of years, that we have an Air Quality Act, that we have a Waste Act. So for a long time, big industry, most industry, polluting industry, has been operating in pretty much a vacuum as far as standards and air pollution criteria are concerned.
So these folks came up to this protest, and at one point I noticed they were all behind the gate. They were not permitted at the time to come into the area. And the next time I went out, they were actually coming into the hallway. So some negotiation had gone on there.
Yeah. The hosts of the meeting, NERSA, the energy regulator in South Africa, pretty much realized that they had been remiss and there was an oversight on their behalf in not facilitating community participation. To start off with, when we were sitting in the hall, most of the participants were other stakeholders, mainly business. The organizers quite quickly realized that a very strong community presence hadn't been accounted for. They certainly hadn't facilitated it. All the community groups that were there because they made their own way there. And because of that, I think they decided to let them in.
Mm. And there was actually a very interesting and long roster of people that got to speak, a lot of whom were speaking from the community perspective.
Yeah. The reason for that was that the week prior to the hearings, community groups had among themselves begun mobilizing and having many information dissemination type meetings in order to raise awareness of what was going on, to raise the bar in terms of understanding the urgency and how big an impact this might have on them. So people were quite motivated to come and to be there in strong numbers, and we certainly filled the hall up, which was fantastic.
It was. I remember hearing that the people that were protesting could come into the hall on the expectation that they wouldn't sing and they wouldn't howl. And I thought, well...
In Africa, you wouldn't expect people not to sing.
I know, exactly. And I don't think that they did sing, though, right?
Yeah, which is a shame.
Right. They were very supportive of the people that spoke. But so let's go back to Eskom now. Here we have this huge company. It's providing all of the electricity in the country. At one point, it was running with a surplus, and it's now having real problems providing enough electricity. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, Eskom is often described as a rudderless public enterprise, public utility, because of not only what has happened in the past, but also what it proposes to do in the future, and how it proposes to go about what it's doing in the future. In the past, on the back of the expectation of commodity booms and on the back of commodity prices, Eskom pretty much modeled its expansion on supplying cheap electricity to energy-intensive users such as smelters, aluminium smelters, ferromanganese smelters, chrome smelters, and trying to attract overseas companies on the back of this promise that it would provide cheap, endless supplies of electricity. Of course, not taking into account the true cost of electricity, which is not only the environmental and the public health cost of electricity, but also that the contracts that the nature of the contracts that underpin attracting this type of business means that these contracts remain bulk supply and very, very cheap in nature on the basis of bulk supply. And that if supply is uninterrupted, that reneging on that part of the deal would mean penalty to Eskom, and reneging on the duration of the contract or fulfilling the full term of the contract would also imply some sort of penalty on Eskom. However, a penalty on Eskom is not just a penalty on a company, it's a penalty on a public utility, which is owned by the government, by the people. That sort of gives you a description of where Eskom's come from and where it's at the moment. 2 years ago, in 2008, at the beginning of 2008, the lights went out, literally, in South Africa. And this was because of a huge exercise in load shedding. Eskom did not have the capacity that was needed to supply its bulk customers and also its domestic residential customers. And following that, a crisis ensued, and Eskom has now used that crisis as a justification for expanding for a new build program.
And the build program is dependent on coal?
Unquestionably, yeah. It is wholly dependent on coal, and it will pretty much tie us into coal for at least the next 30 to 50 years. It's underpinned by three massive six-pack coal-fired power stations, generating effectively doubling the electricity generation in South Africa. Now, why is this a problem for community groups, for community people? Well, 80-odd% of the electricity in South Africa is used by these bulk electricity users, by the mines. And effectively, if you had to raise the price of electricity by 35% across the board, that would be an unfair cross-subsidization of this new build by the users who use the least amount of electricity would have to pay the most for that electricity. Mm-hmm. So that these long-term contracts with these aluminium and these metal smelters won't be affected just about at all by this tariff increase because of the nature of the deal. And the problem with these deals is that they're secretive. Nobody has seen any of them.
Despite the push for transparency.
Unquestionably, yeah. I mean, it's generally thought that a residential user of electricity pays up to seven times more than an industrial use of electricity, and that doesn't, notwithstanding what the bulk users, what the smelters of electricity pay for the electricity. Nobody quite knows what that is.
Mm. The people in South Durban are living in apartments, and all of they're wired. But then there's a lot of informal settlements that are growing fast around the country.
Yeah.
Do they have access to electricity?
Well, that's an interesting question. The commitment by governments is that everybody should have electricity and everybody should have a free basic allowance of electricity. At the moment, it's 50 kilowatt hours per month. However, those 50 kilowatt hours of electricity pretty much get used up quite quickly. And then people use electricity and they have to pay for electricity. Invariably, people who are poor can't afford to pay for electricity, and then they get cut off. Once they've been cut off, what happens next is quite cynical. Eskom, or the municipalities within which these people live, are subject to prepaid meters. And if they can't feed the meter, they can't get electricity. So what is the construct? What is the social construct of this dynamic? In the most electrified areas of South Africa, especially in the Highveld, where we have a very cold winter scenario, up to 50% of users of households that have electricity don't use electricity for all their domestic needs. They use coal or fossil fuels to cook their food and for spatial heating. And the extra burden on them is that most of the coal-fired power stations are based on the Highveld, where the coal reserves are. So people who invariably are poor and live near coal-fired power stations can't afford to pay for electricity for all their needs. They therefore use fossil fuels in a domestic setting. So they're doubly impacted by the coal-fired power stations because they breathe in the polluted air that the coal-fired power stations spew. But also they breathe in the polluted air from burning and using coal indoors. And I've even come across some recent research that shows up to 1 million users, 1 million households in our richest province in South Africa, in Gauteng, and its immediate surrounds, rely on domestic fuel for their needs.
Hmm. Describe what it looks like up there on a particular, in a winter's day.
Oh, it's quite horrible, really. It's, in some cases, it's Dickensian. The construct of our meteorology in South Africa is that on the Highveld, you have absolutely zero precipitation for at least 4 or 5 months of the year. And you have very, very stable atmospheric conditions with low inversions, which means that any polluted air that rises invariably is trapped underneath an inversion layer, a cold layer of air that sits above the Highveld pretty much, and it traps the pollution.
Mm-hmm.
So it means that it's particularly the conditions, the atmospheric conditions that favor dispersion of pollution are non-existent, and pollution remains in the air. So any pollution that's added is compounded upon itself. So it's dusty because many people don't have tarred roads. It is smoky. The air is acrid, and you know, people in the Highveld suffer as a consequence. Up to 9 working days per person are lost on the Highveld.
Due to illness?
Due to respiratory illness.
Oh.
And this research is not even coming from community groups or from government. It's coming from industry itself, who are negatively impacted on because they don't have the consistency in their workforce over those cold, bitter months.
So these companies recognize that this is going on. They're putting out the data. Are they? What are they doing to... Are they using scrubbers in their industries? How are they responding to that?
What government has done, which is hugely proactive on their behalf and is a result of many years of community campaigning and community activism, is that within the air quality legislation that we have, there is special dispensation to identify and declare what are called priority areas, priority airsheds, where pollution is particularly bad. And within those priority airsheds, within defined time periods within the Act, all stakeholders, including industry, government, and civil society, must collectively respond with integrated air quality plans in order to try and address this pollution. So it might mean that some industries will have to put in pollution control devices. It might mean that some industries will have to pollute less or change some of their processes. A lot of the air quality legislation is based on the best available technology for various industrial sectors. So if technology exists out there that is better or that is reasonable in comparison to the technology that is currently being used, then that transition needs to be made. Quite similar to what happened in the US in the 1970s. As far as communities are concerned, well, it's very difficult for poor communities who rely on fossil fuels to meet their basic needs in their homes to make the switch. And one of the interventions that's been proposed by industry and also by government is a cleaner method for burning coal. Its nickname is the BASA. And it's basically how to stack a brazier or how to burn a fire in a clean way in order for less emissions to accrue from that. However, community groups are very wary of, you know, the reliance on this methodology in order to charter a way forward towards a healthier future. Basically, what people need to do is not have to burn fossil fuel in their home. They need a greater allowance of free basic energy. You know, that might mean anything from 200 kilowatt hours per month to whatever. When government is building homes for people as part of the reconstruction development program, those homes need to be better insulated. They need to use better materials.
Is that happening?
No. No. It's unfortunate, but no. Those homes need to be constructed with hot water, but hot water heaters. You know, in South Africa, we're blessed with the sun. We're blessed with 300 odd days of the sun each year, no matter where you are in the country. And for us not to use alternative renewable energy is a great indictment, I think, of not only the leadership of the country, but also of, you know, the leadership within the private sector, and Eskom should also be, you know, looking at cast that among this.
What is the renewable industry at this point? Is it growing? Is there interest?
Like most other settings in most other jurisdictions, it is wholly, wholly under-subsidized. Not enough money at all is being spent on exploring what the potential is for renewables or for alternative economies based on renewables. You know, I've said previously that we're blessed with the sun in this country, and in some of our provinces we have nothing but sun. In the northwest, in the Northern Cape, and in the Limpopo provinces, you probably have 350 sunny days a year. And, you know, for us not to have small decentralized village level or town level economies that are based on renewable energy, particularly solar energy, because there's such an abundance of it, you know, it's very sad, I think, because it would mean that we would be able to address so many of the challenges we have in South Africa, that unemployment, skills development, you know, research and development in some sort of sectors finding employment for people that have been laid off as part of the, you know, the global trend of laying people off in terms of this recession, this global recession. You know, we'd be able to address all of those issues. You could do it as part of a public works program, an expanded public works program, you know, similar to some of the public works programs that you have, you know, the people in the US might have experience of after the Great Depression.
Now, Rico Europeado's view expressed here was reiterated at the NERSA hearings held in Cape Town shortly after the Durban event, when Deputy Chair of the South African Wind Energy Association, Mark Tanton, stated that Eskom's tail was wagging the energy regulator's dog. In his submission to NERSA regulators, Tanton stated the Department of Energy's integrated plan was published after Eskom published its own three-year energy plan to NERSA, which included the tariff hikes. Tanton said the Department of Energy's plan should guide Eskom's energy plan, not the other way around. Quote, the government said 30% of electricity must come from independent power producers. We don't see this in Eskom's multi-year price determination. Unquote. The government's white paper of 2003 states that 4% of electricity produced by 2013 must come from renewable energy. Based on Eskom's projected electricity consumption, this would be 4,700 megawatts, but Eskom's three-year plan states that only 400 megawatts will come from renewables, which is a huge departure from the white paper. Tanton said few renewable energy technology installations could be completed in just 3 years to generate 4,700 megawatts, although wind energy could come close with 3,000 megawatts. Tanton said, quote, Eskom does not take wind energy into account when it comes to baseload generation, which is the same thing as believing the world is flat. We read into this that the future Eskom sees is very dark. That is, it is all about coal. It will be business as usual, and it's wrong. He said that Eskom wants to maintain its control, and that means keeping to business as usual, since, quote, it has spent 50 years planning one way. It is difficult for Eskom to change. If you're just tuning in, this is Raising Sand Radio on KZSU FM 90.1, Stanford University. Let's return to Rico Europeado of Groundwork, discussing renewable energy sources. So there really is very little discussion of this other than we ought to, we should, we must. There's really no, very few organizations on the ground trying to put something together at this point.
There's very, very little action on the ground at all. And the reason for that is because there isn't enough money, or there isn't money on the table to do that. One of the interventions that Eskom has at its disposal in order to avert having to build a huge coal-fired power station at the cost of whatever, $10 billion US.
Which is what this 35% increase is supposed to be going toward.
Yeah. One of the interventions that Eskom could do is to install 1 million solar heaters on people's roofs, you know, to facilitate their process, to subsidize the process, to make it easier for the consumer to do that. To date, not even 3,000 solar water heaters have been installed across the country.
Through Eskom.
And this is, you know, this is year two of their solar water heating plan, or their plan to avert having to build a coal-fired power station. And this is, you know, just for domestic uses. It really is almost unimaginable the level of inactivity that goes into non-renewables. Because this massive rudderless peristatal is so intent on doing the only thing that it knows to do, and that is to build new coal-fired power stations to extract coal and to burn vast, vast quantities of coal.
You're listening to Raising Sand Radio on Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. I'm Susan Gallimore talking with Rico Europeado, a research campaigner with Groundwork, about recent hearings about rate hikes from South Africa electricity provider Eskom. And why should you care about these issues? For one thing, Eskom creates electricity by burning coal, and coal is a primary culprit in environmental pollution impacting climate change. These events trickle down to you and me and the least politically powerful. Well, now, it's actually not only a domestic South African issue here. South Africa is one of the countries that are producing huge amounts of coal, therefore contributing to our overall global warming.
Yeah.
We've just recently at the Copenhagen summit saw South Africa, Brazil, China, India pulled together.
Well, civil society has begun calling this grouping of people carbon Tsotsis. A Tsotsi is a South African ism for somebody who is involved in skullduggery, who is almost a local, small-minded criminal. And this grouping of people, effectively, what they have done is totally undermined any possibility of trying to set targets in order to address and reduce the reliance on coal in these massive coal-based, you know, economies. We have very, very mixed feelings about Copenhagen. I think what transpired there at the end was very sad, and generally it doesn't meet a global agenda, but instead tries to address the needs of these few emerging economies that believe that they have some sort of legitimacy in using coal, you know, for the foreseeable future.
And calling it clean coal.
Yeah, there is no such thing as clean coal, unfortunately. You know, often we as ordinary citizens or civil society, we consider coal in only the context of it being burned and of the air pollution. But if one looks at the full life cycle of coal, you can quickly realize and quickly come to see what a broad impact, you know, coal has, from mining to transport to cleaning to disused and abandoned mines and the subsequent water pollution that results, to the burning of it itself, to the residue from it. Doesn't, you know, once you burn coal in a coal-fired power station, it doesn't just go away. You have a residue. You have up to 40% ash, and you have concentrated toxins within that ash, and they need to be disposed of.
In fact, we just had a major catastrophe in Tennessee where a couple of these sludge ponds burst and went into a local river. So I think that was the beginning for people in the United States to begin to see that coal really does underpin even our electrical system there.
Yeah.
Kind of out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah.
And so what should people in the United States know about how to join, for example, these people in South Durban who are so concerned? It seems as though if we're going to have any impact globally, we need to be joined together as a community of concerned global citizens.
Unquestionably, we need to think or understand our struggles locally, and we need to begin to act globally. And part of acting globally is lending solidarity to each other and understanding where we've all come from and, you know, what ties us all in together in this global picture of inequality and environmental degradation and hopefully not environmental disaster. I mean, climate change is something that is often thought about as being something that will affect the planet and will destroy the Earth. Well, climate change, you know, is something that's happened before, and invariably the Earth as biological system, you know, will respond to climate change over a very long time span. Climate change, I think, will affect people. It'll affect us as people in a much more severe and harmful and impactful way than it'll affect the globe over the longer term. You know, we as people, we need to be mindful that it's going to be a huge challenge for us, you know, for humanity. You know, ultimately it's humanity that needs to respond to climate change.
How can people express their concern to a company like Eskom?
I mean, people need to respond to climate change generally. They need to respond to the impact that Eskom will have on their lives, because the emissions from Eskom aren't necessarily geographically bound to an impact on Eskom. Those emissions of climate change chemicals, of small residues of mercury that are embedded within coal, all of those pollutants, all of those toxins ultimately circulate globally and will have some sort of a global impact. So we need to act as part of a global community in response to that. It's not that you know, US listeners won't necessarily be impacted on by Eskom's emissions. You know, those fish advisories that occur in your state, which means that your children can't fish in those lakes anymore because the levels of mercury in those fish are too high, you know, to be consumed by people. The levels of mercury in tuna globally that live in our oceans is so high that pregnant mothers, you know, in the US can't have more than one helping of predatory fish a month. It has a global impact. We need to act globally. We all need to know that we are all equally affected by this. You know, companies like Eskom hide behind this emerging or developing economy facade that we should be treated differently, we should be special because, you know, we're in the third world, but it's going to affect us all.
Mm-hmm.
You can't use those arguments anymore. They're not legitimate.
And this is the work that Groundwork is engaged in.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately what Groundwork seeks to achieve in all of this is to not necessarily illustrate the, you know, the bad practice that Eskom is tying us into, but also to show that you know, we all have an equal responsibility in raising our voices against something that is inherently wrong. And in this case, you know, Eskom is proposing to tie us into a fossil fuel economy for the next 30 to 50 years. It will stagnate any reasonable inroads into renewable energy. It will contribute to global emissions. It will have global impacts. It's not right, and that's why we're taking this so seriously.
Let me remind our listeners that we're talking with Rico Europido, a research campaigner with Groundwork, and Groundwork has actually an enormous amount of information on its website, which is groundwork.org.za. Go there and you can actually download a lot of your reports. Annual reports come out, very excellent reports, and I highly recommend them to people. I'm also sitting here looking at one called the World Bank and Eskom. What can we share with our listeners about that?
This report was commissioned directly in response to the Copenhagen negotiations that took place recently in December. Essentially, what the World Bank is intending to do is to provide Eskom with a loan, in fact, a massive loan, a loan of $5 billion US, which will be the biggest loan it has ever given to an entity in Africa in order to fund its new build.
So this is over and above the money that's going to be generated from the population with this 35%?
Unquestionably, yeah. The 35% tariff increase will pay back this loan to the World Bank. That's its intention. And, you know, the World Bank describes the loan as one that will help the electricity sector achieve financial stability and increase generation capacity and efficiency and adopt a low carbon trajectory. But, you know, that's totally at odds with what this loan will ultimately do, which is fund a carbon intensive industry that will consume vast amounts of carbon and emit huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere over the next 30 to 50 years, which again is at odds with the World Bank's mission statements. Well, I mean, one of the concerns that the World Bank has is that it needs to reposition itself as a friend in need, you know, to African countries. But a lot of the analysis and the reading into this report, shows that ultimately what will happen is that a lot of the investment that is proposed, or a lot of the money that the World Bank will invest in South Africa, will in fact be repositioned ultimately with those big multinationals, and that the return on the investment will ultimately be embedded within those New York, Melbourne-listed companies in the form of refined smelted metals, because the profits from that will never be realized in South Africa. Mm. We're talking about export-based commodities, and that's exactly what they are. So if the World Bank provides, you know, loans to economies in order for those loans to realize profits for multinationals, then that's the way we're reading this particular relationship between this World Bank loan and Eskom.
This is the document called the World Bank and Eskom Banking on Climate Destruction.
Yep.
It's on the website.
That's Rico Europedo with Groundwork, groundwork.org.za. Go there to get more information about Rico and about the work that Groundwork does, also to download any of their documentation, which is all free if you download it off the internet. It's also available to purchase the books and the reports.
If folks drop us an email, if they write to us and request any material, we would be more than happy to mail them a copy of this material.
Great. Thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And that is our show for today. As usual, all views and opinions are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Tune in again next week to listen live, U.S. Pacific Time, Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. at Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. You'll find the coordinates for the live streaming on our website, which is raisingsandradio.org. You can also download all of our shows at raisingsandradio.org. That allows you to listen at your convenience. So email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org to comment on any of our shows or suggest topics for future shows. And let's go out with Bob Dylan again and Ain't Talking.
The suffering is unending. Every nook and cranny has its tears. I'm not playing, I'm not pretending, I'm not nursing any superfluous fears. Ain't talking, just walking, walking ever since the other night. Heart burning, still yearning, walking till I'm clean out of sight. Summer day, a hot summer lawn. Excuse me, ma'am, I beg your pardon.